Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I'm back again with another fantastic episode with an amazing guest we'll get to in just a minute. But as always, I want to remind everybody to go to my website, www.markpattisonnfl.com, and there's a lot of goodies there. Number one, we've got over 200 podcasts with just absolutely incredible people doing amazing things that you can go tap back into on the podcast tab. Of course, please go in and give a ratings and review. It's always very much welcomed. And we have so many people inspiring so many others that the higher and the more ratings you get, apparently in the world of Apple, your popularity goes up and more exposure to the world. And that's what we're trying to do. Number two is we continue to raise money. Go to the philanthropy button through Higher Ground for my daughter, Amelia Zeverest. She's making great progress. We actually just, the other night, we're recording this podcast on July 8th, and we had a fundraiser called Hero's Journey. We raised over $1 million. It was amazing. I got to stand up and speak a little bit. We had General Mattis here in Sun Valley, and just incredible to see what not only the people here, the giving, but also these amazing people that are being helped. And finally, there is a film coming out from the NFL on this whole Everest expedition. There'll be more that we'll be updating on my website, so stay tuned. The film is scheduled to come out in early September, and there will be a premiere here in Sun Valley, Idaho on the 23rd of September. Really jacked up about that. So for more information on the way. Okay, let's get into it. Today, our guest, my teammate, my climbing mate, and I think might even be a soulmate after what we went through. And he is not related to John Muir, but he is the one and only Art Muir. Art, how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's a privilege and a pleasure to be here. And, you know, we haven't talked to each other very much since the expedition. I feel like we were separated in the middle of a torrid affair. So it's good to see you here again.
Well, it's good to see you're standing straight up. And the first thing I want to tell everybody, and I told you this with, you know, complete honesty and being totally authentic, was from day one, I think I was the second oldest guy on that expedition. You were the oldest, not only the oldest on our expedition to 75, but you became the oldest American to ever climb. And I know that's not the reason why you did it, but at the end of the day, you did do it. And what is also fantastic is, and you're probably the same way, at the very beginning of this, we started with 21 climbers. And at the end of the day, there's only 10 of us who made it. And so that's more than 50% that did not. And I know that when we, you know, in the very beginning, when we're going through the Kumba Valley, we have to trek up those 40 miles. It took us 10, 12 days to do that. And you're starting to like, who can make it and who can't and who's going to be there and who's still standing. And, you know, there was a moment in time when you were coming into, I think it was Camp One, and I had actually climbed out of my tent and to come help you. And I begged you to let me carry your backpack, you know, the nether 75 yards, which were excruciating for you because I'd been through it, and to come out and help you and carry that bag for you. And you absolutely refused. And from that moment on, I said, you know, this guy's a flipping warrior. He's 75, but he acts like he's 35. And,
you know,
and so much of this was just about a mindset that you were going to get to that tent by yourself with that heavy pack and go through those, even though I was willing to give you the kind of the out, and it was an easy out too, because you'd already got to Camp Two. It was just kind of the extra steps. But, you know, as we sit here, what comes to you in terms of, you know, we're now like 45 days off the mountain, reflections upon that experience that you and I went through together?
You know, Mark, I remember that. I remember that so well. And it's not like I was, it's not as if, you know, I'm afraid to have people help me, or I'm not willing to take, you know, assistance. I had plenty of assistance and plenty of help, you know, from you and other members of the team on this climb, from the Sherpas from the guides, from everybody. And I just remember that. And it was more the kind of the thing I think I remember, you know, I trudged all the way up there and it was like, you know, and you were really gracious to come out and see that. I was really tired and I was really, you know, fatigued. But I just want to do the last few steps. I thought I could make them. If I didn't think I could make it, I would have been happy to accept the help. So, you know, it's interesting now because we're back here, you know, about a month away from having summited. And it's such an interesting thing because, as you know, because you've done a lot of this, that was your seventh summit. You've climbed all the highest mountains on all the seven continents. Among other things, you know, it's a remarkable accomplishment. But it has this air of unreality. I mean, there's a couple of things about it that I find surprising. First of all, and I've said this before, and it's absolutely the case. When I got to the top, I was as surprised as everybody, you know, as anybody. I mean, it was just, to me, this was a question of doing this trip. I'd been there before. As you recall, I'd been there in 2019. I'd hurt myself because I was careless. I fell in a crevasse, something you only don't want to do once. You don't want to do that twice. And the second thing I did was I fell off a ladder just from a lack of attention, a very foolish, you know, careless mistake. And in big mountains like this, you can't make foolish and careless mistakes, or maybe you can't get away with it for very long. And so this time I came back a much more, I guess, kind of aware of the challenge, but also much more focused than I was the first time. It took me a long time. And, you know, there's two elements of these climbs. One is it's the physical preparation. You have to be physically ready. And I really had questions. I'd worked really hard. I know, you know all about that, you know, and other members of our team who were successful know about it too. You have to prepare physically, but you also have to prepare mentally. And you have to be prepared to focus on this for days that aren't so easy. Some days are better than others, but some days are really hard. And you have to be able to find a way to focus and hang in there and not give up. And then the third thing is, you know, in addition to having everything else, the support team, you know, you got to have great guides. You got to have great, you know, the Sherpa help. You have to have a great teammate. So we were very fortunate to have a, you know, fabulous group of people, really. You know, and I know you feel like I do. You feel like they're blood brothers and sisters. It's almost like a tribal thing. You got to have all that. You got to have a staff and you got to have all those things. But you also have to be really lucky. You have to be lucky. You know, you have to have the right weather conditions. Things have to open up for you. And these mountains are really demanding. And there were people who were actually at Camp 4, had gotten all the way to Camp 4, done three rotations like we did, been there for 60-some days, all ready to go for the summit, in really good shape. And their Sherpas got sick, and that was the end of the expedition for them, an external factor. So it's a whole bunch of things. So now sitting, you know, at home where I turn the faucet and the hot water comes out that I can immediately get hot water and every, you know, the water I no matter what water I take, I can drink it safely knowing it's safe. The food I get is all fresh and it's, you know, convenient and abundant. So you go on these expeditions, it's not like that, you know, and we had good food and we had safe water, as you very well know, because the staff took such good care of us. And nobody on our expedition got sick from things like COVID or food poisoning. So we're really lucky, but it makes you appreciate how lucky we are. So I think, you know, on the one hand, I kind of look back and think, did that really happen? Did we really spend 60 some days in a sleeping bag, you know, climb up this mountain three times and through this dangerous ice fall and these winds and storms and like you on the summit night, you know, with the wind blowing and the granular snow blowing in and resulting in a snow blindness in one of your eyes. And did that really happen? You know, it's hard when you're here to think about that. It was a remarkable experience.
So I want to go talk about where you and I think more or less got separated, which is kind of from the time that we got to Camp 4, really Camp 3. I want to go back on that in just a minute, but I'm really fascinated because there's so many people like yourself that, you know, you're a lawyer for many, many years. You're since retired. You've got all these other things. And so many people talk about once they retire, they're going to go do X, Y, or Z. And then they finally get retired. And then they have all the time in the world to go do X, Y, and Z, but they don't because now you know, it's the old saying about if you want to get something done, give it to a busy person, right?
Right, right.
So,
yeah.
And so I'm, and this probably goes back to your childhood or something. So I want to dig in about where did this sense of motivation, it's really self-motivation of wanting to pursue adventures and pushing yourself to the limit. And for you, and again, you, I didn't look at you as any different from me or some of the younger kids, you know, that were on the expedition. We had one, what, 20 something kid, and you know,
25. Yeah,
25. And we were all equal. Right. And you were right in that group. I was in that group. I was the second oldest guy. I'm 59. And so for those people who are out and they're thinking, well, I either got to, when I retire, I'm going to do this, or where did that motivation for you start?
Yeah, it's two really good things wrapped up in there. Three things, actually. One, the first is kind of in reverse order. The first is, if I remember all three of them, but the first is, you know, being with a group, our group, for a long period of time without a mirror. I've mentioned this before, and I didn't really realize it until afterwards. But, you know, you're with somebody, with a group of people, and you're doing a lot of things, and that group spans, you know, Ben Barris was 25, I'm 75, and there's a bunch of us who are in their 50s, and then, you know, a few in their 40s and like 30s. So it was, you know, but there was a concentration of people in their, especially guys in their 50s. I thought that was kind of interesting. And after you spend a lot of time with a group like that, you stop thinking about kind of how old you are, and you start thinking about what the group is doing and what other people are doing. And so you just become part of a team where you're looking kind of through their eyes. You can't see yourself, really, because there aren't any mirrors. I mean, I didn't have any mirrors. I didn't look. But you see it through their eyes, and you start to identify with them. And for me, that's a huge advantage. I think it's a disadvantage for people that look at me and think, oh, those guys are like really old. You can see an old guy. But for me, you know, seeing a bunch of people who were younger, stronger, fitter, just more capable, more enthusiastic, you know, and participating, just makes you feel mentally a lot younger. So that was number one. Number two, I grew up, you know, I wasn't an athlete. I mean, somebody like you, you look back on an athletic career, you've got that kind of history, big time, first rate, first line athleticism. You know, I don't have that, but I was an active guy, active person. And I grew up in Colorado. My dad actually gave me a book, Maurice Herzog's book on Annapurna, sometime when I was about 12 or 13 or 14. And that was one of those books that fired my imagination. It's a stunning story about the first 8,000 meter peak that was ever climbed back in 1950 when they were looking for mountains. They weren't even sure where all those mountains were. So that was really a big deal. I was also a scout, spent some time scouting, and that was really a good experience for me. You know, it wasn't the only thing I did, but it was really good because it got me outside, got me doing things, you know, pursuing nature merit badges, learning how to tie knots, learning how to make campfires, going on hikes, you know, stuff like that. Again, it wasn't a big deal, but it's still really vivid to me. Those memories are still vivid. The time that I spent and the skill set that you pick up when you're in that age of, you're first a Cub Scout, then a Boy Scout, but that age of 11 to 14, something like that. It's a time for boys in general, I think, that they're really particularly impressionable. And then I was, you know, pretty active. I went to a small high school, small private school in Denver, and that allowed you to do everything you wanted to do in terms of sports. So you want to play football? We played football. Now, we only played 8-man football, and you played both ways because we only had enough guys to field a team. So, you know, there were 13 guys in my graduating high school class, 13. So you want to play basketball and you're 5'4"? No problem. You know, you're in. So that was actually really good too. And I think there's something to be said for that, as opposed to my kids all went to a very fine public high school here, Neutra High School, but it had over 1,000 kids in every class. So my son Charlie played baseball, but you know, that's what he had to do. He had to specialize in that. There aren't any, you know, two-way football players. There are very few multi-sport athletes in high schools like that. So I was very lucky to get exposed to this. And I guess nobody ever said to me, you're not good enough to do that. Because if you can walk on when you're 5'4" and play basketball, or, you know, you can walk into a football team and play it, you get the idea that you can do these things. So that was actually really, I think that had a lot to do with it, just exposure early and kind of enjoying it and the variety of it. And then the third thing is, you're absolutely right. We all have this tendency. It's procrastination. It's part of human nature. And we all have these similar things. And what I did was I had, I got really lucky because I'd always been fired by the idea of Mount Everest and the highest mountain. I wanted to see it. That there was something iconic about the mountain itself. It turns out it's just a big pile of rocks. Yeah. Pretty dangerous. It's pretty impressive. It's, you know, it's just a pile of rocks. But no, I didn't know that at the time. In 1990, I saw an article in the New York Times about Jim Whittaker was organizing an expedition to the north side. And he would take trekkers. And he was a smart guy because he said, and if you make a contribution, and it happened to be $10,000 per trekker, you can go and then meet the team and go to base camp and do all this cool stuff. Mm-hmm. So I did that at the risk of losing my job. I was working for a firm and that required 31 days away. And it wasn't something people did. And people just didn't do that, you know, mm-hmm. practicing law at the time, 1990. And so that introduced me. I went to the north side. I actually got up to advanced base camp, saw Jim Whittaker in the tent at advanced base camp called The Whale on a very windy day, because it's always windy, you know how it is. The tent is flapping and he's in there and he's talking to Robert Link and John Gall, who were going to be getting ready to do their summit climb from that advanced base camp. They're going to go climb the top of Mount Everest. I mean, holy smokes, that was like, I was like on fire with the thought that they were going to go do this. And I came out of that tent and I was on the way back down because I didn't stay at that camp. I went down a little ways on the Wrongbuck Glacier. But I looked up at the North Col, and the North Col is a lot lower than the South Col where we were. On the south side where we climbed, it's 26,000 feet. But on the north side, it's about 22. And it's only about, I don't know, it's a few hundred meters above advanced base camp. But it's a head wall, and it's, you know, it's heavy duty, and trekkers don't go white walking up there. That's where the real climb starts. And I looked at that, and I thought to myself, you know, I don't know, but I think I could climb that. I could actually get up there and look over the North Col of Mount Everest into Nepal. Of course, I was on the Chinese side at the time. I could look into Nepal, and I thought, that would be like the coolest thing to be able to do that, to be up on this saddle and look over into Nepal. And then I thought, you know, I looked up the rest of the mountain, and of course I thought, dude, these guys are just like pros, and they're Superman and all that kind of stuff. I could never do that. But the idea of getting to something like the North Col, you know, really fascinated me. So when I got the chance, I did that tour, and then, I mean, I did that trek, and then some friends asked me to try and climb Denali the next year, which we did, four of us on a private climb, and we ended up, two of us got to 17,000 feet, got really, really cold. The other guy got frostbite, and that was the end of that trip, fortunately, because I had no idea what I was doing. Okay, I was so far over my skis
That's a tough
one. And I went back to work. Yeah, I went back to work and sat at the desk for a long time until a friend of mine. What happened was a friend of mine, you know, this is the way these things happen. I'm finally answering your question, okay, about procrastination in older adults. A friend of mine finally called me up and he said, you know, Art, I'm gonna, he'd been doing a little bit of climbing. He went out to Rainier and he climbed Rainier because, you know, and he enjoyed that a lot. He said, I'm gonna go to Ecuador and climb these volcanoes and I'd like you to come with me. And he's a long-term friend. I mean, he introduced my wife and I, and his now wife, then girlfriend, was Leslie's roommate, you know, so that's how we met ultimately. So we've known him for 50 years. And I wasn't so, you know, so taken with the idea. I'd been sitting around that, you know, behind a desk. I hadn't done, played golf maybe, you know, and I don't know. I basically hadn't done anything. A little bit of exercise kind of. And I came home and I said to Leslie, you know, Jim wants me to go to Ecuador and climb some volcanoes. I kind of was thinking, you know, why would I want to do that? Why would I want to go to Ecuador? I wasn't even sure where it was, okay, yeah. To be honest, and climb volcanoes. And there's this pause, and she turns around because she was at the sink in the kitchen, and she turns and said, well, he's your friend. Of course you're going. So I, you know, ended up going down to Ecuador to climb these volcanoes. And what I discovered, here's what was so interesting. The point was I didn't really know what I was getting myself in for, which I think is a good thing, especially when you get older. It's really important to kind of reach out there, get over your skis a little bit, get in the water when you're not exactly sure how deep it is. And I had these two wonderful guides from Rainier Mountaineering, Solvay Waterfall, Casey Grant. Casey was actually in Kathmandu and on Everest with us again this year. He's climbed it several times, works for CTSS. And they did a fantastic job. The point was, it was so great to watch how they handle it. There's another guy, Jaime Villa, who's a local guide who's climbed some of these peaks, Capaxi, number. And they were so competent, you know, they were so professional and they were so interesting. They had good stories. They knew what they were doing. They took me, you know, to a place that otherwise, tops of these two volcanoes, that otherwise I would never have seen. And I enjoyed the process. I kind of enjoyed the exertion and then the satisfaction of getting on top. But I also enjoyed meeting the other people who were on the climb. And then watching them as professionals. It was so great. So it was a whole new chapter that kind of opened. I didn't realize at the time. And I came back and the next big step was I saw that there was RMI had an offering for a trip to Mount Elbrus, the highest mountain in Europe, although some people think it should be Mount Blanc, but nonetheless, Mount Elbrus. And the thing that was so cool about this trip was you didn't just climb it. You could also actually ski off of it. You could ski off the top. I can actually climb up this thing and ski off one of the seven summits. I mean, that was like the coolest thing I ever heard in my whole life. Oh. So I signed up and it was run by, the guide was a fellow named Tyler Reed, Pacific Alpine Guides. It's gotten to know him really well. He's a super duper, you know, neat guy and a, you know, an excellent guy. And he's been all over the world. And I've been now done backcountry skiing with some of the people I met on that trip and then some other friends, you know, and we've had chances to go to these unbelievably cool places to do backcountry skiing. We did the Russian trip to Elbrus. We've been to Sentry Lodge in Canada where you're dropped for a week by a helicopter. They come back a week later and pick you up. We've been to Japan, Hokkaido. Then we've been to, Tibet in the Wrangell St. Elias National Park in Alaska. I mean, an unbelievable place, many thousands and thousands of square miles of which have never been walked on by humans. And they have these fixed wing aircraft. They drop, you know, with skis and they land and pick you up later in the day. It's so cool. And we've been to Chile. So, you know, this was something that was completely unexpected in my life. And I've now got in the climbing, same kind of thing. I've done some other trips. You just don't go, as you know, you just run over to Mount Everest and just decide to climb it, especially when you're my age. But it's been kind of a gradual process. And the point is, in answer to your question, I think it's particularly important as you get older to keep doing new things and not being afraid to take some of these adventures. I mean, you don't have to climb Mount Everest, okay? I mean, that's really cool. But it's things, it's getting yourself up and out and meeting other people. And I'm on a kind of as an aside, I'm on the board of a senior center here in where I live. And I've been on that board almost 10 years now. And so you learn a lot about seniors and kind of what works and doesn't work for them. And this is a place where senior members of our community can kind of come in. They can do a bunch of things. They can get together for lectures and lifelong learning classes. They can play cards. They can do sculpture classes. They can take trips. You know, it's a bunch of things like that. But it's a thing where people get together. And what we found out, and then we have a lot of social services where we go into the homes of people in the area in our 38 communities on the north side of Chicago. And we go into their homes and we make sure they're taking their medications they're supposed to be taking and things of that sort. So it's social services primarily. And what you discover is as you get older, you tend to be afraid to take chances and do new things. And what happens to some of these people, especially with social services, is a spouse will die. You know, they've been married for a long time, lived in a small house, done this kind of thing. A spouse dies and then the survivor starts to become afraid to do anything, to go outside, for instance. And then, you know, they become paranoid and then they get depressed and then they get sick and then they die. And one of the good things about the senior center is it provides an outlet for people to come out, get together, do things together, which is very reinforcing, really positive. You know, we as a species grew up in tribes. We like to be together. Okay. And that's one of the things that the senior center does. And so my advice, among other things, is for older people is, you know, get out and keep doing things, meet new people, try new things. That and do some real exercise, not this foo-foo stuff. Do some real exercise.
Well, I would certainly say thanks for the recap and all that. And I would certainly say that applies for all ages, not just seniors or whatever the term senior. I don't know if I'm a senior, but it's just, I think the bottom line is
you're mighty close.
Yeah, well, it doesn't really matter. It's just, you know, I will never retire, and I will. I always encourage people to step into the fear and go after things. And, you know, to your point, stepping into the fear might be, you know, learning how to knit or playing the guitar or something like that. You don't have to go climb Mount Everest. And at the same time, you know, I like to say to other people, you know, like, what's your Everest? It doesn't have to be literally Everest. It's just like, what are you going to do to challenge yourself to put yourself in a position where you're going to grow? Okay, so I want to fast forward.
Before we leave that, though, Mark, you're a great example. You're a great example, because here you were. You have this career as a professional football player. I mean, a remarkable accomplishment in and of itself.
Yeah.
You know, and of course that career comes to an end. And what you've done is you've done all of these other things since then. I mean, you know, your climbing the Seven Summits is only one small part of it. You know, Higher Ground is another, you know, raising money for charity. And you've done a lot of that for not just them, but for others. The idea you're doing podcasts with all these people. I mean, I'm pretty flattered to be on this, to be quite honest. I'm not sure that you'll ever run this podcast, but nonetheless, it's flattering to be asked to be on here. And the idea that you've done 200 of these already is a great example of how people can still stay involved. I mean, I and I'm sure it's true for you, know people. I mean, in my field, in practicing law, half the people are looking forward to retirement. Half of them are afraid to death of it. You know, they really don't know what they're going to do after they quit practicing. And so, you know, that's a really sad thing, I think. The idea that, you know, thinking life is, it's one thing if you love your work. It's another thing if you're doing your work because you're afraid there's nothing else to do. Okay, those are completely different things.
Yeah.
And for the first, more power to them. But the second, though, they're missing out on something that it's just, there's no end of opportunities. And you're absolutely right. Everybody should have, and probably does have, something they want to do and try. Learning how to play the piano is a great example. You know, or the saxophone or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, or play the guitar or sing or whatever the deal is. Everybody wants to do stuff like that. And retirement, especially as you get older, gives you an opportunity to do that. It's like a birthday. It's like a holiday every day. It's the best.
Well, I think the other thing that you mentioned earlier is the social engagement. I remember at 17,500 feet, for everybody that has not been there, which is, I'm sure, most of the people are listening to this right now. And at base camp, there's one kind of grand tent where you meet, where you eat all your meals, and where kind of the whole internet set up. And a lot of people gather, you know, during these periods between we'd eat, and or you were always down there, and there was always one or more people that, you know, were coming in and out of the tent between guides or Sherpas or fellow climbers and things like that. And so at the end of the day, we're all social creatures, and to have that community. And you only get that community if you put yourself out there. There's outside of Koki, who I climbed with her on Denali, I didn't know one person besides Garrett, you know, our team leader, on yet the entire time I spent no time with Garrett for the most part, because he was off doing his thing. And I met all these new guys like you and girls. And the other cool thing was they were all from different nationalities. So it wasn't just about like kind, but it's really spreading your wings. Okay. Let's go to when we finally decided to go to for the summit. What a lot of people don't understand about when you say, hey, let's go for the summit, that really starts five or six days before you're actually going to go for the summit. And I've got this great photo I took. Well, you remember this one. It was, I think it was the 14th, and they stood up there that night and they said, we've mapped this whole thing out. We've studied the weather patterns. And we think we're going to go start in tomorrow, because we think the 20th of May is the day, right, that we're going to go for the summit. And then they even have the 23rd. Right. We're back down at Everest Base Camp. Or 22nd, we're
right.
back down.
That's exactly right.
Yep. And right. So as it all played out, to your earlier point, like so much of what happens on Mount Everest, you know, at the end of the day comes down to luck. And in our case, we had a cyclone on the kind of the front end and the back end. And so you pointed out where some people got up there to camp for, everything looked great. And then some people got sick. Well, I had some people from Alpine Ascents that went up there the day after and that cyclone hit and all that moisture came down. There's 4 feet of snow and their whole expedition got cut. They did all the things right. We just happened to guess and thread the needle and get lucky. And that's the only difference between our group and other groups that were out there. But when we got up to Camp Four, and it's no place that anybody wants to vacation for sure. It's torn up, it's barren. Yeah. 6 feet away from my camp was a dead body from, I believe it was the May 12th expedition when he got up and died of exposure. And, you know, there's a lot of just oxygen tanks and, you know, other things are just scattered around from past expeditions. And so certainly a lot of the chaos that went down in 1996 in the thin air, a lot of people have read that Crack Hour book of that account. A lot of it went down, you know, right there. And so, you know, now we're there and you jump in your tent. I think you're 10 minutes with Kevin. I'm in there with Koki and Chrisley. And so now the whole plan is to get up at 11:30 or so and get ready and to launch out at 12:30. Take me what happened for you, like from that point that we got up there, you went and now you're getting up, getting ready to go in your account. Cause I think you left maybe an hour or two before the rest of the group left.
Right. That's exactly right. So what they did was they recommended that I leave at 10 o'clock, knowing that my pace, as you know, from our climbing together, is just slower than other people. You know, I try to make sure I'm moving at a pace where I can continue to move to get where I'm going. And that usually works pretty well. But if I try and move at somebody else's pace, like for instance, for me, climbing Denali where you're roped to other people is much more difficult because it's their pace as opposed to here where you're with your Sherpas, but you're not roped to other people. You're on fixed lines on the mountain, protect yourself, but you're moving at your own pace. Now that creates some problems sometimes because really slow people create hazards and blockages and things of that sort. But anyway, so we're at Camp Four, 26,000 feet. Because you're already in the death zone, you're on oxygen. So even when we're resting in the tent, at which we had to spend an extra night there, as you'll recall, because of these storms, the wind is howling, the tents are blasting back and forth. You really can't hear it inside the tent when you yell at each other. You can hear each other when you take your oxygen masks off. It's really hard to communicate. And when people come around to the tent for various reasons, you really can't hear almost anything they say because it's so noisy. And that wind is just roaring through there at roughly 40 miles an hour the whole time with gusts that make it sound like it's a freight train. So, you know, you've kind of been in this tent longer than you expected. We're already behind our original schedule, which was written on the back of a cereal box. I remember that. I have a picture of it, too. Yeah. You know, we're now trying to climb on the 22nd for a summit on the 23rd. So we're 3 days. We've already been on the mountain above the ice ball 3 days longer than we expected. So we're kind of pent up. On one hand, you're getting a little bit of fatigue. On the other hand, you're getting, you know, finally getting some excitement. So I'm supposed to leave at 10 o'clock. I remember this so well. So I wake up at about, I start getting ready at about 8 o'clock or 8:30. I'm just to be ready by 10. Now it's hard for some people who haven't done this to appreciate why it would possibly take you so long. So first of all, you're 26,000 feet. You got this oxygen tank on. You can take this mask off. You can, it's not like you're going to die if you take it off, but you do become breathless and it's harder. It's much harder to breathe. So you kind of got this thing on your face. And then what you have to do, you're in your down suit because we're living in those down suits, but you got to get your boots on. And the boots, in my case, actually have three levels, like a little booty, an inner boot, the outer boot. You got to get that on. And you got to get all your rest of your stuff. You got to find your zip yourself up. You got to get some water. You got to get some snacks to eat on the way up. You got to get your head, your beanie on your head adjusted. You got to get your goggles ready. You got to get your helmet on. You got to get your gloves. There's any number of things you're futzing around with. Then you've got to collect your harness that you wear to protect yourself so you can be clipped to the lines. And then you get all that stuff ready. Meanwhile, there are three people in a tent with a lot of gear and not a lot of room to move. So it's hard to just move around. And, you know, you're all trying to get ready. You're in each other's way. A lot of elbows and feet and stuff like that. You're all trying to get ready because Kevin and I, and Rick Irvine were in the tent. We were all trying to leave at the same time at 10 o'clock. So the Sherpas are outside. They're kind of waiting and you're getting kind of anxious because they're, you know, we're getting behind. So you get out there, you can't hear anything. The wind is blowing like crazy. Now you got to get your crampons on. You got to get your pack out. You got to get your ice axe, you know, attached to your pack. You've got to get, I can't remember, you know, you kind of got to get all set. And it's hard. The wind is blowing. It's hard to stand up. And, you know, things, you got to get your climbing harness on and do all that sort of stuff. So you finally get that done and you're late. All right. I'm late. It's like 15 minutes after 10 or something. I can't remember exactly. So I'm feeling this anxiety to get going. All right. Once I get going, I'm okay. I mean, I tend to be okay. You start out over this trail to the triangular face. And the thing that people don't realize, and I didn't really realize, is just how steep Mount Everest really is, all the way, really, especially from the south call to the top. But we have pictures from friends that climbed Lhotse. They show the picture of Mount Everest, and you just don't realize from most pictures how steep it is. But I walked over to this kind of snow field, and then you get to a point where the fixed lines that you're going to be attached to while you're climbing start. And I remember looking up, and it's late at night. I mean, it's the middle of the night. It's, I don't know, by this time it's, you know, 10:45 or something like that. I look up, and I remember, you can always see when you're climbing at night, no matter where you are, it seems like somebody else is always ahead of you. You can see the headlamps in the mountains for miles. I mean, just for absolute miles. So it's really easy to see the people that are ahead of you. And I remember looking over and looking up, and it was so steep. When I looked up, I felt like I was looking at lights, and the lights went all the way up, you know, way up in the sky. Mm-hmm. It looked like I was looking up an elevator shaft. Yeah. It was so steep. I just remember that so distinctly. So I said to myself, okay, I'm not looking up there anymore, because that's too discouraging. I mean, that's so steep, I can't look at that. So I started grinding away. The wind was blowing, there was snow blowing from the left side, I think, from our left side as we were climbing up.
It was
there.
Left to right, yeah.
It was supposed to clear, supposed to calm down. It was supposed to have stopped at 6 p.m. that night, but it was still blowing, but we were going anyway. And I'm climbing, and I remember, you know, the only thing you really see are your feet, your kind of your, the front of your boots, and kind of where your headlamp, you know, the steps that you're following, the fixed line that you're following, and the Sherpa. Now, in my case, I had two Sherpas, one who'd been working up high in the mountain to try and get ready, and one I'd been working with all through the climbing. So I had a Sherpa in front of me and a Sherpa behind me to assist with things like changing the oxygen and stuff like that. So we, you know, we're working away, and I'm doing okay, you know, but this is high. I've got an oxygen mask on. You can't talk, of course. It's noisy. The wind is still blowing. You're just trying to make forward progress. And I thought of it as, I think about it now, I was just grinding. I mean, I'm just grinding away one step at a time. And I was trying to be, as I had been on this whole trip, really careful about my foot placement, because I'd already had two accidents in the 2 years before when I'd come. I'd fallen in a crevasse because I wasn't careful, and I'd fallen off a ladder. So my track record wasn't exactly stellar. Mm-hmm. So this whole trip, I was really careful about trying to place my feet just where I wanted them. And I was pretty good about that. I mean, I didn't have an accident. I didn't get hurt. So, you know, in hindsight, I was successful. And I'm grinding and grinding and grinding. And I remember all of a sudden we come up after we've been working, you know, climbing for a while, come up over a rise, turn right, and there are all these lights are there. All these people are there. I thought of it as, it was like coming into a football stadium is what I thought at the time. I couldn't understand what, then I realized we were at this place called the Balcony, which is one of the few level spots, maybe the size of, you know, a large, I'm trying to think of like a large garage or something like that, kind of that size. And there's a bunch of people there, and there are a bunch of headlamps. All of a sudden it's, you know, all kind of people move in different directions as opposed to up the fixed line in one direction. And it's an oxygen bottle change. But I'd had a lot of trouble. I personally had a lot of trouble. My mask wasn't on right. I hadn't put the straps on quite right. Or when I put my helmet on, it kind of knocked them down. So I had to adjust, take my helmet, my hood, my helmet, my headlamp, my goggles off to get my oxygen mask on. And my Sherpa freaked out. He thought I was going hypothermic, ripping all my clothes off, which people can actually do when they start to have hypothermia. He thought I was going to, you know, get frostbite. But we got that all squared away. And so I went to the next step. And, you know, you're working hard, not panting hard, but just making sure, you know, the body's working hard, you're at high altitude. And I remember, again, some time passed, and I was thinking, you know, this has been a long time now. I'm hoping to see a break in the horizon over here and see the sun coming up. And I remember not very long after that, another distinct memory for me, I looked to my right and I could see the thinnest, faintest line of light. And I knew that was going to be the dawn coming up. And for me personally, that was a huge moment. That was so reassuring. I got so kind of re-energized by that, even though it was still dark. And by that time, by the way, you'll recall that's about when you were a different spot because you started later. That's about when the wind died and that everything, you know, changed. It just made things so much more enjoyable. And then the sunlight starts coming up and the line, you're just kind of glancing on the side of your eye, kind of watching this, gets brighter and brighter. And then we came to an area with some rocks and it was, headlamps were off by that time. The sun was up, I think almost fully for me. And the series of rocks, and I looked at this, you know, what do I know? I hadn't been there before. And I thought, I wonder if this is the South Summit, you know? I mean, I'd heard that, but I remember so distinctly, I walked up over this, across these, up and over these rocks. And then I saw that Cornice Ridge that runs to the Hillary Step. And for me, that was my moment of emotional kind of, kind of being flooded with the emotions, because I thought that was the South Summit of Mount Everest. I'm going to climb Mount Everest.
You're right there. You're at the front door. You can see the top.
Yeah. Because before you don't have any bearings and, you know, especially if you've not done it before, you have no sense of where you are. But for me, that was a really emotional moment, but there wasn't any time to linger. You know, there are people behind me, there are people in front of me. They're not chock-a-block, but you know, you're close. You're 3 to 4 feet apart, something like that, passing somebody once in a while. And once in a while, at that point, people are starting to come down and bend to the top. But I remember that was a really powerful thing. Then you're going along that Cornice Ridge, which is a lot of exposure. You've got exposure on both sides. You're being careful. But it was so gratifying to be there after having seen for so many years those iconic pictures. Mm-hmm. Of course, most people remember it from 2019, where it was just chock full of bodies. I look at those pictures now and I think, what a mess that was. And ours was not, you know, for me, that was pretty good. There were some people coming down, there were people going up, but we could get by each other okay. It was really not, you know, too much of an issue. You had to be careful. But the Sherpas have done this so many times that they really are very helpful with that. And then all of a sudden I'm at the Hillary Step. I'm going like, holy smokes. I mean, my whole life I've heard about the Hillary Step. I've known it. It's iconic, the name itself. And I'm climbing, we climb through it now because it isn't really there like it used to be. I'm climbing through the Hillary Step, knowing that right on the other side of it is the final summit. It's the final slope to the summit. And then I'm going up this slope. It's still steep, as you'll recall. You're still roped up. And I can see people on the top of Mount Everest. I mean, they're not very far away from me. I don't know, 100 yards. I don't know whatever it was. And then, I kind of go up to the top of Mount Everest. And I'm expecting to have this area, which is flat, where I can kind of stand up and enjoy the fact that I'm on top of the mountain. And there is no flat area. It's like a kicker on a ski jump. It goes up in a ramp. And then it comes to a ridge, and that's it. And when I got there, about 8 o'clock and I was tired. I think I somebody asked me in an interview, I actually misspoke. I said I was so tired I couldn't stand up. That's exaggerated. I mean, I was tired, but I'm also monitoring myself because we have passed some bodies hanging from from the ropes on the path, as you know, people who had gone up, some had come down and died. And I'm thinking, I don't know exactly what happened to them. So I'm thinking, how do I feel? What happened to that person? They just suddenly just stopped breathing. I mean, did they know it was coming? Did they have, you know, indications where they're, so I'm a little concerned about the fact that I'm tired, but I feel okay. I mean, I hadn't stopped. I only had about 2 ounces of water going up, which was not smart. I had one goo. That was not smart because it was so hard to get to my stuff in my suit. I hadn't practiced that. Yeah. I learned from that. That was a real mistake, but I didn't, you know, I'm kind of monitoring myself thinking, are you okay? Everything okay? Are you going to be able to get back down the mountain? Because, you know, I wanted to get up it, but I certainly wanted to get back down it more, okay, safely. And I felt okay. And so when I got to the top, my hands are a little cold. I'm kind of sitting there and I'm thinking, and there are a bunch of people around the actual marker that's on the monuments on the top. So you really couldn't get over there. You're going to have to kind of hang around. And my job, my thought was, you know, unlike, we'll talk in a second, maybe you can talk about how you felt. But for me, there wasn't this great exhilaration feeling of exaltation. Kind of, I'd already had that feeling when I came over the South Summit. For me, it was an absolute feeling of job done, mission accomplished, time to go home. So I was on top for, I think, about 7 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, the day was nice. It was clear. There was a little bit of wind. It wasn't bad. It warmed up a lot, I think, after that. But for me, it was get out of Dodge, because I didn't know if all of a sudden you just, you know, you collapse and die. And I wanted to get down while I still felt good. So I started down, you know, almost right away. And it's a long way down there. When you're going down in the sun and you can actually see the mountain, which you can't do when you're climbing in the dark, of course. And also when you're climbing uphill, you don't get a feeling for how big things are. When you're going back down, you realize just how huge this thing is, how big the mountain is, and why it can absorb a couple hundred climbers and not be crowded on a given day. So that was kind of my, you know, kind of my experience. And getting, by the time I got to camp, back down to Camp 4 at the South Col, I was really, you know, I was really exhausted then. I mean, I was really wiped out, that last kind of last walk. But I didn't get that feeling until I got pretty close to the bottom. So thankfully, I never had that feeling like, whoops, you're going to die, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, all that stuff is real. That's just a great account, you know, and I'm glad to have, you know, you share that with me. There were some similarities and some vast differences. You know, we left a couple hours later. They forgot to wake us up. And so you talked about, you know, starting to get your stuff ready with an hour or two before, and we had 20 minutes. And that's just not a way to go take on Mount Everest. That's one. Number two is, I had a really tough time, you know, again, you had said it right. We were like 3 days behind schedule already. And I had talked to Garrett about this early in the expedition, that I just didn't function well on freeze dried food. I kept repeating the same thing and they kept saying, we'll work it out. Well, it never got worked out. And so I wasn't eating. So just even getting up to 26,500 feet, I was low on energy and, you know, I was sucking eggs. You know, I just wasn't consuming the kind of calories I needed to consume going up. And so when we got up, and as you stated earlier, I got snow blind because there was a strong left to right 45 mile per hour wind going with small ice particles. And not only did my eye get wiped out, but my side of my face, I developed this huge scar. Chris Lee got the same thing. And it was pretty ugly. Yeah, it looked like a sunburn. And then going up, that's probably the one reflection I had was just how steep that face was. There was never a break until we got to the balcony, which was just for a moment. And then we kept going up the mountain. And I had a very strong Sherpa. I just had one Sherpa. And you know, he wanted to pace me at a pace on that day. I just couldn't go. Normally, I was pretty strong, but that day I wasn't. And so, you know, really going up and surviving it and getting through. And, you know, I was actually up on the summit. I was actually the last person to leave the summit. I was the last person to come into camp. I was out there for 18 hours. I ran out of oxygen, just under the balcony, and my Sherpa had gone down 200 yards below me and he wasn't with me. And he was in such a rush to get back. And I was really sucking eggs. I was literally scooting down the mountain on my butt. And so I was like saying the words, today is the day that Mark doesn't die, and having to fight through all the mental battle of what are you going to do to keep yourself going and keep moving and moving. And then the kind of the thing that really was difficult for me, and I couldn't process it right because I wasn't thinking about it, is, as you know, now we come into camp and now it's around 6 o'clock and I climb in the tent, and about 9 o'clock, after having had a tank refilled, about 9 o'clock that night, I ran out of O's. And so by about 10, and poked his head in the tent and said, hey, and the winds had picked up, like you said. And he had said, hey, is everything okay? And I said, well, I ran out of O's. And he said, well, we ran out. You're going to have to share with the girls. And so I didn't process the fact that I was actually supposed to go up and do Loti later that night, which I'd canceled, but I'd already bought 3 extra tanks. And so I don't know why he told me that. And I just said at the time, I said, okay. And of course the girls went to sleep and I spent the entire night at 26,500 feet with no O's. And I was hallucinating. I was trying to climb out of the tent. I mean, there was a lot of wacky stuff that was going on there. And then the next morning when I started going down the mountain, I'd gotten up early. I thought I was the last one to get out. And I was all goofy in my mind. I ended up climbing down, you know, from Camp 4 down to Camp 3 and over, you know, the Loti face by myself. Nobody was with me. And
holy smokes.
Yeah, Perba had told me to go down because I thought it was the last one out. And it turned out it was the first one. And so no support. And so I just had all kinds of problems. I don't blame Garrett or anybody else. And some of this stuff was certainly preventable on my end. But you, like you said, you know, you're just not thinking the way you need to think about how do I access food and did I bring enough? And there's water bottles and they don't freeze. And all these things were, as I sit here today I'm at sea level, I'm Sun Valley at 6,000 feet, but you know, your mind is clear and you can think about it, but
right.
I've had some almost like PTSD post like what happened of what if and what could have been. And so I go back to that word that you used at the very beginning of the podcast called luck. And so much of the luck of the weather and the luck of COVID and the luck of the cyclone and the luck that we didn't get our whole group knocked out just because three other people got sick that knocked the rest of us out who were healthy. There's all these factors that played into it. And then I would go to that summit night and I said, holy smokes, you know, so many things could have gone wrong and they did go wrong. And we were still able to come together as a group and most of us make it.
Yeah, I didn't know. Somehow just because of our schedules, I didn't know that. I mean, I just had no idea. But I can't imagine, you know, if that had happened to me, we may well not be having this conversation. I mean, seriously, you know, just given the reserves, I will say that I am very sympathetic to the this question about freeze-dried foods. What I've discovered is there's the bland stuff is what I can handle. I mean, I can eat it. The other stuff, you know, that has noodles and some other things in there, just certain composition, I can't eat. So, and if you don't do that, as you know, Mark, if you don't do that, if you can't refuel yourself and drink enough water, and I had some issues with being dehydrated in a couple of days, but I think when you're older, you become less aware of thirst. And just, you're just not very good at it. I just wasn't careful about that. I was careful about other things. And it just, your body just can't handle it. You know, you see it in athletes all the time. You see it in things like the Tour de France and other kinds of, you know, athletic endeavors. We've all seen that. But over a long expedition, it's not just a short-term deal. You know, once you're out, it's really hard to catch up, especially when you're at an altitude where your body doesn't process the food very well anyway. So, I mean, I can't imagine how challenging that was, but I also know you well enough to know that you just basically willed yourself through it. I just know you. I mean, I've seen how you do things and how these things happen. I know that's what happened, which is fortunate because it could have had those situations can have a different outcome.
Yeah. I mean, look, we all have to tap into, and I think this is, you know, finding your summit all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. That's the name of this podcast. And you know, we've all had our bumps, and certainly I found myself of trying to find my summit. And my summit was, like you said, when I sat down on the top, I was just like, you know, rather than jump up and put my hands like, this is the greatest moment in my life. It was like, now I got to go all the way down. Like I got to fight through that.
Right.
So now you're tapping into things that like my daughter who has epilepsy, you know, things like that, that all the support that all of us got, you know, like I can't quit for them. I can't quit for her. I can't, you know, you got to come up with your strong why on why to survive. Right. And this was like literally a test of survival.
Yeah.
And so,
a lot of people climb Mount Everest, and I give them all absolute credit for it. You know, it's really, really difficult. But because of that, I think people who haven't done that can often poo-poo it, thinking it's just basically a slog and a line of people going out there, just kind of going through the motions, grabbing a peak, and, you know, and it's not that big a deal. And it is that big a deal. It's a big, hairy, demanding, challenging, you know, difficult, dangerous mountain. I at first, when I was there, I couldn't understand why if somebody who had climbed it and came back would ever want to do it again. But now I fully understand it, you know, because it's like everything else. You kind of get you get perspective on these things. And one of the things that I've done, you know, to the point you were making before is each time I've done these two trips to Everest, I've come back and written down stuff that I either should have done or that I'm going to do next time, which is things like thinking, you know, being more thoughtful about food and water. Now you say, how can somebody, you know, train for 3 years and do this and go to a mountain like Everest and not have thought about that. And I have thought about it. You know, I thought about it a lot. But you learn things and you learn about your body and what you can and can't do. And I will say this thing about mental toughness is a huge factor. I climbed Denali with my son in 2015, a time when I thought that was kind of the early part of my, you know, I'm doing this because he wanted to do it. And it's one of the greatest moments. Staying on top with him is one of my five highlights of my life. But what I remember from that is not so much my climb, as he was 26 at the time, or he's 25 and turned 26 a couple days after we got down. He had the opportunity to do something that not everybody gets a chance to do. And that is, when he's relatively young, go on something that is an expedition like Denali to find out what he's made of inside, deep down, you know, inside where the guts are, where the grit is. Because on Denali, you have to dig deep. It doesn't matter who you are. You have to do the work yourself. There are no Sherpas. There are no porters. Nobody does the work for you. And there are no shortcuts. And so he had the chance to find out whether or not he had that, you know, just for purposes of the rest of his life. And he was really lucky, you know, and so in some ways to have that opportunity, you're really fortunate if you know you have that kind of, if you can call in those kinds of reserves, because life requires that sometimes. And I think it's something you can develop. It's also nice to know that you have that. So I think that's what these expeditions prove. It was a marvelous experience. But I want to say a couple things. Number one, my first impression when I went to Everest in 1990, and then again in 2000 and on the north side of the trek, and then 2019, and then again on this trip, 2021, you know, having climbed it now. Mount Everest is an amazing place, but it's still just a big pile of rocks. Okay, it's just a big height, the highest pile of rocks, but that's all it is, a pile of rocks. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing, you know, beyond that. But what's so special about these trips, that achievement itself is remarkable, but the people on these trips and what you come away with, these, you know, kind of these relationships and seeing how people react to them. And so we were so lucky this year to have such a fantastic group of people on the team. I mean, just interesting. You were really good about, you know, asking people, and because you're used to doing this and you're good at it, asking questions about people. I started to do it on this trip just for lack of something, you know, for because I was bored and I decided to find out about people. Asking questions, and when you dig in, you find out we had a really interesting, diverse, remarkable group of people who'd done a lot of things, came from a lot of different places, came, you know, had a lot of different backgrounds. We had three PhDs in our climbing group. I mean, I don't know how often that happens, but it was surprising to me. People doing really interesting things in their work, too, just remarkable. So there's that. So that was one of the things that's remarkable. The other thing that's remarkable to me too, and the thing I've talked to other people about, especially as somebody who's older, and that is, if you are lucky enough that you haven't had a debilitating disease or an infirmity of some sort that really limits what you can do, that even when you're older, if you do the right kind of exercise, you can do amazing things, you know, physical things. In other words, you don't have to climb Mount Everest, but you don't have to sit on a couch thinking, I can never do this. I can never do a bicycle touring trip in Europe, or, you know, walk across Costa Rica on some of these guided expeditions that they have. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things, but you can, if you do the right kinds of exercise, you can still do these things in life. And it's better to be strong than weak. Okay. That's just, you live a better life when you can pick up the kids' car seats when you're a grandfather like I am, with six grandchildren. When you can pick up that car seat because it goes in and out of the car over and over and over, and it's designed to be heavy and awkward, but you can do those types of things, your life is more enjoyable. Plus, you can do a lot more things. So my message really is, you know, don't sit on the exercise. And when I say that, I mean exercise that includes moving heavy objects around, lifting them up, putting them back down, moving them from side to side, whatever it might be, you know, dumbbells, kettlebells, barbells. That stuff's really important, especially as you get older. There's this feeling we have that I see too many people who are afraid to do heavy exercise. You know, they're afraid they're going to get hurt. And when they do it with the supervision of somebody who's good, and there are a lot of good trainers and people who know this stuff, when you do that stuff, it's not only good for your muscles. That's the thing. It's not just about building muscle. It's firstly, when you're older, it's preserving muscles that you have too, because, you know, we tend to lose them as we get older, but it's you know, it's good for your joints and your ligaments and your tendons and your heart and your lungs and your brain and your circulatory system. It's good for everything. So my message really is that people should be doing those types and seeking out those types of exercise. It's good for them, and they'll have a better life.
Well, you are certainly one that has done that all the way to become a world record holder. I know that was never your intent, but the fact is you are, and landed you on Good Morning America or one of those shows that I happen to be in the background on. I claim that was all about me, not you, but it's all good. Listen, Art, you know, you're a great mentor to me. You're a great success story. It's a privilege and honor for me to have been, call you a teammate and climbing mate. And I was so, so happy to know that you summited that mountain after what we all went through. You know, that mountain was such a test of endurance, if nothing else. And we saw kind of one by one of people being peeled off the mountain for various reasons. And we were able to go the distance. So thank you so much for being on the show, finding your summit, and best of luck to you in the future and all your other endeavors you have going on.
Been a pleasure, Mark. I look forward to skiing with you someday. Thanks again.
All right, buddy. Take care.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Attention parents and grandparents. If you're looking for a gift that's more than just a toy, give them something that inspires confidence and adventure all year long. Give them a Guardian bike, the easiest, safest, and number one kids bike on the market. With USA-made, kid-specific frames and patented safety technology, kids are learning to ride in just one day. No training wheels needed. It's why Guardian is America's favorite kids' bike and the New York Times and Wirecutter's top pick 3 years in a row. This holiday season, Guardian is offering their biggest deal of the year. Up to 40% in savings on all bikes, plus $100 in free accessories. Guardian bikes have become the most sought-after gifts of the season. And inventory is going fast, so don't wait. Join over 500,000 happy families who've discovered the magic of Guardian. Shop now at guardianbikes.com. That's guardianbikes.com.